This is the third report that we've been able to put together. It is a comprehensive outline of what we've done in the last year, but also sets out the aspirations of where we particularly want to go. As you know, the third report highlights the many positive developments in the safeguarding ministry in the Catholic Church in England and Wales, whilst also acknowledging that there is no room for complacency, and indeed there is much still to do. This is particularly true in response to the Church's response to survivors of abuse, and the NCSE is both challenged and heartened by the fact that, in particular following the Pope's visit, more people have felt confident enough to come forward to report incidents of abuse in the hope of finding some kind of reconciliation and closure. And working to provide a safe and encouraging framework to support survivors is the top priority for the NCSC. I think it's particularly important because we'll know that one of the biggest challenges we've had in the past is to help victims to feel confident that if they disclose, something will be done to address their ills. And perhaps, therefore, the fact that many people who were abused in the past are now more confident to come forward. So if you look at the report, you'll see there's an increased number of people who were abused in the 60s, the 70s, and before, who are now coming forward. And I see that as a very positive opportunity to attempt to deal with those historical issues, but also to learn from them, so that as we go forward and we hone the new procedure, we can take into account the lessons learnt from that abuse and what happened, and make the process that we now adopt more sensitive to the reality that victims find themselves in. Now, during 2010, there was obviously a change in chairmanship. Bill Kilgannon stopped as being chairman in December of last year, and I came on board in March of this year, as I've already indicated. And we have set ourselves some challenges for the future. You'll know that we are developing, or trying to develop, a more appropriate response to survivors. We're monitoring the safeguarding practice through a national audit process, and we're working with the religious and on a one church approach. So we're trying to restructure the commissions and linking the religious congregations so there's a greater degree of synergy. But I think we understand that this is very much a journey, and that there is much more to do in relation to having a system which will accurately support and reflect the sort of approach we would like in the longer term. That's all I intended to say to start. Obviously, we're open to questions. As I say, I have with me Adrian Charles from CSAS and Sister Jane Bittleson, who has been involved in these matters for a long period, and we're open for questions.
You mentioned that you're looking to find a more appropriate response to survivors. What does that mean practically? Is that going to be a fund for compensation? Is that going to be a fund for counselling? How is that going to work?
I think the first thing to understand is that we are listening more acutely to what victims tell us their needs are. I think that's a very important part of the journey. You'll know that when the Pope was here, he made it clear that it was part of the Church's mission to understand the plight that victims find themselves in, to give compassion, support to them. And so we are looking now at what in practical terms that actually means. There is, as you know, a twin track process, because some victims clearly and properly wish to take proceedings in relation to what has happened to them. Some don't want that, some want some other form of healing, and I think we need to be very sensitive to listen to what their needs are as we go forward.
Adrian, do you want to?
Yes, if I can add to that, and I think the idea of a specific fund has potentially got some inherent faults in it, in as much as that we should be looking to respond to individuals' needs based on that individual's needs, rather than have an established amount of funding per se. And as Baroness Scotland says, often what's required by the individual who's been damaged is nothing to do with money. It's other forms of healing. So I think what we're looking to establish is a form of dialogue and mediation really with individuals as they come forward, so that we can meet their needs as expressed by them.
And I think that means we've got to create a safe space anywhere across the church in England and Wales where people feel they can come and talk. And we're currently, it's in place, a training programme offered to us through one of the survivor groups that we work with, to ensure there are people in every diocese who have had training to receive victims who might want to come forward. So it's creating that safe space is really, really important. You don't want a postcode lottery on that kind of thing.
But you also need to inculcate a better understanding of what abuse looks like within the broad church. And I'm not just talking about the religious and the priesthood, but within the laity too. Because what we know is that, unfortunately, abusers aren't easy to identify. Many of them are very plausible. They are people who are quite often loved, respected. They are people who have been quite skilled at persuading people that the facade they present is the reality. And so helping congregations, other members of the religious community, and priests to better understand and to watch out for the signs that might indicate that abuse may be happening is going to be of critical importance. Because if we are to create a real, safe, robust environment, it will take all of us, not just the leadership of the church, but actually the laity working with them too. And that's why we're very grateful to all the hard work put in by members of the local commissions who are seeking to keep their area safe and put in robust, well-seasoned procedures.
The report mentions that you think that Pope Benedict's visit had a great impact.
Yes.
Can you tell us the proportion of people making allegations before he arrived and the proportion after in 2010?
Well, there seems to have been, as you'll see from the report, a significant increase in the number of people coming forward. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a direct correlation between the visit, and then you'll know there was a pontifical letter written in May also. And since that time, there seems to have been quite a significant increase in the numbers. And I think Adrian will be able to give some...
Yes, I can't give you actual proportions, other than to say that there was an increase in allegations made from around about July, August onwards through to the end of the year. And
I don't know the proportion,
I'm afraid, no. But there's significantly more in the second part of the year than in the first part of the year. And a number of people that disclosed to my office, the national office, because that was the only point of contact they knew, openly stated it was the papal visit that brought this to their mind.
So the abusers were saying this?
Yes, yes.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
And I think what it did is it gave a lot of comfort to those people who had never disclosed to anyone. I mean, some of this abuse, you're finding that you've got people in their 60s. These are mature people who have had something happen to them, perhaps during their childhood, and they didn't feel able to share that with anyone. And so the fact that people are able to do that, I think we need to see as a very big positive step forward. Abuse of this sort used to be things that people kept closed in a cupboard. No one talked about, no one touched, no one was able to disclose, because they were so terrified about what it meant about them. Quite often victims took a lot of responsibility onto themselves and thought they were responsible in some way for what had happened to them. And I think now that people are able to talk more openly, there is a better understanding that it's not the victim's fault. It is the abuser who should have responsibility for what happens to them. So that's why I talked earlier about us being on a journey of understanding, and that that understanding will need to be deepened and broadened. I mean, I've been dealing with issues of child and vulnerable abuse for more than 34 years, and there are still things which shock, surprise, disappoint and sadden me. But I'm still learning about the pernicious nature of this abuse, and am very, very proud that hopefully some of that experience can be put at the disposal of the Commission to help shape what our response will be in the future. But I don't underestimate how complex, how difficult, or how painful this process may need to be.
Could I add a point as well, that in the build-up to the papal visit last year, there were a number of survivor support organisations that articulated very clearly the feelings of the people they were representing, and that was very helpful in terms of people being encouraged to come forward.
And I think one of the things that we clearly haven't been able to concentrate on enough in the past, but would like to do in the future, is many people who are not abused by those within the church, but are abused outside of the church, come to the church for succour, for understanding and for support. And so for those members of the congregation and religious and priest community who are faced with those disclosures, they're quite often shocked and appalled because they've no experience of it. And so I think we do need to sensitise people so that when victims come to the church who haven't been abused by the church but have been abused by someone or something else, the church can provide that warmth, support and understanding. And I know, for example, that when we had the safeguarding conference in Rome, many of the archbishops and the bishops were greatly shocked by the nature and extent of abuse that happens generally in our community. You will have seen from the conference that we had psychologists, victims and researchers giving us a greater degree of information about the global picture of abuse generally, not within the church but in the general community, and helping people to learn and understand that generically, the generic nature of abuse, I think is a very important step. And I hope that when the church has been able to address some of its own systemic problems, it will be better able to assist people in the community who come to it for help.
You've got over 200 covenants here now. They haven't increased greatly this year, but could you say something about how that operates?
I think maybe Adrian.
How the actual covenants of care operates.
And the number of people you've got supervising.
Yes, well, it'll vary depending on the nature of the covenants, inevitably. But just taking as a kind of an example, you have a prisoner who's approaching release from prison who is considered to be a potential risk within the community. The prison service will contact the safeguarding office, and between them they will sit down with the individual, usually the prison service and the probation service, and map out exactly what type of activity that person would wish to have within the Catholic community. Often it's something very straightforward and very simple. Simply, they want to worship within a Catholic church. So the safeguarding coordinator will find out which parish church is the most suitable, which is likely to present the which church is likely to have less risk factors involved because there are less young people, for example, which church service the person should attend, and might have two or three people within that parish that are aware of this individual who will attend the same service and make sure that everything progresses smoothly. That's at one level. At another level, it could be that you're actually looking to put together something along the lines of a circle of support approach to assist that individual in having an offence-free life on release from prison. And we're looking, certainly in the future, to work much more closely with the Catholic Chaplaincy Service in the prisons to identify people that would benefit from that on release once they come back to within the Catholic community.
And what happens to, on my own parish, the two priests end up in prison, and they're probably out now, then what happens to them? Do they get pensions? Do they get support?
Well, canonically, whilst they remain priests, they're entitled to support. Indeed, even if were they to be laicized, they're entitled under canon law to support. It would vary again from individual to individual. It would depend on the individual's circumstances. I'm aware, for example, of a number of priests and religious who have committed offences and have come out of prison and are self-supporting because they have their own means, or others who have been assisted by the diocese to access standard benefit systems in order to support them. There are others who are living within enclosed communities and therefore are supported within the church. So it's a range, really.
But they all come under this covenant of care. They're not just let loose in
community. Oh, certainly not. Yeah. No, certainly not. No, they'd all be subject to a very strict covenant of care, and all withdrawn from any form of active ministry.
Yeah.
The Coyne report recently published in Ireland showed that the church can have the right safeguarding guidelines, but if an individual bishop decides to flout those guidelines, there's not much that can be done. Are you happy in England and Wales that everyone is firmly on board with the guidelines and we haven't got a situation that we have in Ireland? And also, are you convinced that the Holy See is fully on board with the notion of mandatory reporting of allegations, which of course Claudine showed, but there might have been a question over that, or there was a question over that?
And the first thing to say, of course, is that the history of the response to safeguarding in England and Wales has been, as you know, significantly different to that which has been adopted in Ireland. And so from the inception, really, of the last 10 years, the Church in England and Wales has progressively looked at how to improve the coordination and collaboration in relation to safeguarding. It's been absolutely clear that the Bishops' Conference accepted that there should be referral to the civil authorities when such disclosures were made known. If you look at the letter that was published in May of this year, it says, by Rome, it says in terms, and maybe I should just read it to you, because I don't know whether you've all had an opportunity to do so. It says in terms that the authorities should be approach. So firstly, if you, I don't know whether you've got copies, it deals with the victims of sexual abuse and sets out the standard, because it says the victims of sexual abuse, in these encounters the Holy Father has focused his attention on the victims with words of compassion and support. It then reiterates that there is no place in the, which is what something said in 2002 by Pope John Paul II, that there is no place in the priesthood and religious life for those who would harm the young, and gives the responsibility to the church. It then says at E, under cooperation with civil authorities, sexual abuse of minors is not just a canonical delict, but also a crime prosecuted by civil law. Although relations with civil authorities will differ in various countries, nevertheless, it's important to cooperate with such authorities within their responsibilities. Specifically, without prejudice to the sacramental internal forum, the prescriptions of civil law regarding the reporting of such crimes to the designated authority should always be followed. This collaboration, moreover, not only concerns cases of abuse, committed by clerics, but also those cases which involve religious or lay persons who function in ecclesiastical structures. So I think the circular letter, which is issued, as you know, to assist episcopal conferences in developing their guidelines for dealing with cases of sexual abuse of minors perpetuated by clerics, makes it clear that the local church should comply with the law in that country. Now, the way it's why it's expressed in that way is that we know that across the world, different jurisdictions have different procedures and will demand different things, and therefore the circular letter is saying, whichever country you are in, you should comply with the provisions that are provided by the civil procedure, civil process for disclosure. So I think the letter has been very clear. You'll also know that the circular demands from each bishop a plan by next year, setting out not only the guidelines that they've crafted, but how they propose to implement them. So I think Rome is being very robust in terms of what it expects from each diocese, but the bishop of each diocese remains the lead person. So of course, as you rightly say, there will be individual responsibility for how individual bishops choose to discharge that duty, but the guidelines that they will be asked to follow should be clear, should be consistent with the circular letter which has been produced in order to enable them to create robust guidelines. And I know that the Bishops' Conference here in England and Wales have shown appropriate and consistent support for putting in place adequate guidelines to deal with this. And of course, that was the whole purpose of this commission being set up, and the fact that it has amongst its membership not only an independent chair, not part of the church structure, but also a number of people on the commission itself who have experience in child and other forms of abuse of vulnerable people, who hopefully enable us to craft and hone the guidelines in a way that we will be able to better protect the young and the vulnerable.
I believe it's also a strength of the system, in the safeguarding system in England and Wales, that that national model is replicated at diocesan level, so that the way that matters have come to the fore in dioceses are they're reported to a safeguarding commission, which is chaired by an independent lay person and has representatives from police, probation, social services sitting on that commission. Mm-hmm. So there is a degree of independence in terms of receiving those allegations and ensuring the statutory authorities are aware of them.
Tim Wilson-Fogel, just going back to the increase in reports, reported cases after the Pope's visit. I was having a quick look through the report yesterday, and it seemed to suggest that there were about 40 in 2009 and about 80, and I think 83 last year. Is that, have you got that figure? Secondly, what was it about the visit itself that you think made the difference?
I think it was because His Holiness saw the victims themselves personally. He had a number of opportunities to talk to them, to listen to their experience, the pain, the difficulty that they had had, and clearly connected with that in a way that the victims felt was palpable and genuine. And I think that communication with victims in a very direct way communicated to the wider community. So there were opportunities for victims to be heard in a way that hadn't been done before. And I think also His Holiness did that so that he could be an example of how he expected the bishops to care for the victims within their own diocese. It was a demonstration, if you like, of pastoral care that he would hope others would emulate. And from reading the comments that people who went through that experience had, I think that's communicated. And in the report, there are a number of examples given of those who attended those meetings. And it was also, I think, important that when the victims expressed a desire to have those meetings with the Pope on his own, without perhaps some of the other priests present, that was complied with. And so His Holiness was very much demonstrating that he was sensitive to the needs of victims and was willing to listen to them in a way that made them comfortable, as opposed to what procedure would normally have demanded. And I think that was a very good example of leadership.
I think too, the number of times the Holy Father spoke about the abhorrence of abuse and the way that the church just had no tolerance and the despicable nature of it gave people the confidence that if they actually spoke to someone in the church would hear it. And so, and this would be true across the board, I think, the whole area of abuse. There is a language now which people can use in order to describe their experience. And with a sense that the people they're describing it to or disclosing it to would understand. And I think the strong language that the Holy Father used would have been, it was a real help to people coming forward.
And I think one has to remember that in 2003, when the Holy Father was Cardinal Ratzinger, who was then the prefect of CDF, he was the person who was responsible and obtained from the last Pope a concession about the special faculties in order to create greater flexibility in conducting penal processes. And it used to be 10 years. He, as Cardinal Ratzinger, supported and advised it should be doubled to 20 years. And now that he has become Pope, he continued that commitment to this area of protecting victims and has ratified, if you like, a suggestion that he made when he was the cardinal responsible for it. So he has confirmed his commitment whilst Pope that he had whilst cardinal. And I think that's been quite a powerful testament to his longer term commitment to addressing abuse in this way.
If I can add as well to your question, I think it's very difficult to generalise about individual motivations for wanting to disclose at a particular time. Different people will have different reasons for it, and I mean, certainly I could speak on an anecdotal basis about what individuals have said to me, ranging from the this has all been to the forefront of my mind, and on one occasion someone saying that I was the first person they'd spoken to about this, an event that happened 55 years ago, and that was as purely as a consequence of the papal visit. Other people have said that they've been motivated by a sense of anger that the topic is being discussed openly, and they've been sitting on their own rage for a long time. And so I think the important thing is the much more important thing is how they're responded to, as opposed to necessarily trying to guess what their motivation is. Whatever their motivation is, they need to be responded to sensitively and appropriately.
And I think that the important thing has been that people have now felt they have permission to talk about it. That's the big change. It's the fact that they don't have to be silent anymore. It's okay to be angry. It's okay to come forward. It's okay to say this was wrong now. Whereas I think, sadly, from speaking to a number of victims in the past, they thought it was not okay,
and people around them thought it was not okay.
and they would be ashamed. You know, they would be ashamed. And you'll find this not just in relation to sexual abuse of children and young people and vulnerable, but you'll find it in relation to any form of victimization. Domestic violence victims will always often say they were ashamed. You know, they thought it was their fault. They thought they were the only person ever to be abused in this way, and that it was therefore not something they could speak about. It was taboo. Any form of abuse tends to rely on that in internalization that it was, you know, the abuse was responsibility of the victim, not responsibility of the perpetrator. So we're seeing that as a common feature, unfortunately.
Is it possible that there might be some damage to that by the perception now that maybe it's not okay to be angry if you're the Irish Taoiseach?
Well, I think
you might have some repercussions in terms of diplomatic relations with the Vatican if you start.
Well, I think. Well, I don't see any evidence of that yet, and all I can do is to look at the evidence there is about how Rome has responded. You have to appreciate I have only been involved directly in this since March. Having become chair, one of the first things I did was to go to Rome for the safeguarding conference where all the leads came together from across the world to look at it. That was a really bruising and in-depth conference. And I say bruising because it was very painful to watch all those individual cardinals, archbishops, priests, sometimes having to grapple with the enormity of what sexual abuse looks like for the first time. And for someone who knows nothing about sexual abuse, nothing about child abuse or abuse of vulnerable adults, it is very shocking when you look at how these things occur. So we had that, we had the papal letter, we had the demand from Rome that their guidelines be put in place, the demand that by next year everyone should have filed their plans. I mean, certainly, I haven't seen any lack of energy coming from the church about wanting to deal with this. But there is a lot of frustration and anger, I think, through a lot of people feel frustrated and angry about things when they're not dealt with in a way ideally people would like. But I don't think it really will impact on the long-term relations that people will have.
The Seven Rights Signal, the reformer, minister in the
book,
I think so. You're aware of these kind of
messages. Oh, well, I think we need to wait and see. You know, time's really interesting, isn't it? People say lots of things immediately after something's happened. Whether it bears fruit in the longer term, one needs to wait. Anyway, luckily, I'm not here to pass comment on any of that. I am simply the chair of the National Commission for Safeguarding.
My question comes actually from a phone call that came out of the blue yesterday from a lady who said that her parish priest had been wrongly accused and had been acquitted, but she was talking about how painful it's been for him and for the parish, and it's almost divided the parish because some are doing what they can to support the priest and others are saying, oh yes, but there's no smoke without fire and that sort of thing. What sort of support is available for such priests who are themselves victims of abuse, of a different sort of abuse?
Well, I think one of the things, if you look at the circular letter, it does make it clear that one has to investigate these issues in a fair and a proportionate manner, that people are entitled to be treated as if they're innocent until they're proven guilty, and if false or inaccurate allegations are made, then every effort should be made to support that person in the longer term so that their reputation can be restored. And in fact, that is included in the Pontifical Circular Letter specifically. And I think there has to be an appreciation that it is difficult because you have to support a victim who has the right to be heard, but you also have to be aware that proper safeguards have to be in place for those who may have been wrongly accused. And that's, if you look at paragraph D in the letter, it provides that the accused cleric is presumed innocent until the contrary is proven. Nonetheless, the bishop is always able to limit the exercise of the cleric's ministry until the accusation is clarified. If the case so warrants, whatever measures can be taken to rehabilitate the good name of a cleric wrongly accused should be done. So I think it's a balance, and you know, one does have to look at what can be done in individual cases to support those people.
Leading on from that question, when a priest is accused, we've had a number of case studies, people, I'm not going to name names, people who've come to us this year, priests accused of abuse, cleared by the police, but then left in a limbo period for many, many months. Now, Cumberledge envisaged the internal investigation will take 3 months, and then the accused can appeal that to the review board. Now, what we're seeing is the internal investigation taking many months, and people, priests, maybe completely innocent, being in effect tainted. As a former lawyer, are you happy with this?
I'm still a lawyer.
As a lawyer, are you happy that this is this process is satisfactory?
Well, I think one of the things that the Commission aspires to do is to enable a consistent process and procedure to be developed, so that there is one church, a one church approach. As you will know, at the moment, it's not just having guidelines, it's making sure that they are implemented in a way that's consistent. And we are going through an audit process. And as I said right at the beginning, this is a journey, and there is a lot of work still to do.
I'd like to challenge your comment that someone has been cleared by the police. If an individual has been cleared by the police, in other words, the police are saying there is no evidence whatsoever in any shape or form to support this allegation, then there isn't an internal inquiry, because there's no risk. What you're referring to, I think, is where the police said, we haven't got enough evidence to take this to the Crown Prosecution Service with the likelihood that there would be a prosecution.
And
that doesn't mean to say that they've been completely cleared. So as a responsible organisation, obviously, we have to then have our own internal inquiries.
I accept that point. My main question is the time it's taking. The internal investigation by the church is taking well over 3 months.
Not in all cases. I mean, I would agree with you. I think that the shorter that process is, the better. But the complexity of some of the cases that have been through that process means that inevitably it will be somewhat longer than that.
And that's been the difficulty, hasn't it? The individual cases have become much more complex than they might have appeared or might be appearing on the surface.
And I also think, firstly, I agree with you, we have to try and make the period as short as reasonably practicable in order to make a fair and proper balanced assessment. That's absolutely right. It's also right to appreciate that if you look at the civil proceedings, if this was a child abuse case taking place in civil proceedings, the investigation and completion of those inquiries very rarely can be encompassed within a 3 month period. Very rarely. So there are some inherent tensions to do justice, and Adrian's right to highlight the difference between proven beyond reasonable doubt and the prosecutorial test, which will be one, is the evidential test satisfied, and then two, is it in the public interest to prosecute in that case? And you will know that in some of these cases, because of the vulnerability and difficulty for the victims, whether the victims are willing to give evidence, all those sorts of issues are likely to impinge on the prosecutor's assessment of the likely success of prosecution. The church has a different and broader responsibility, because the church has to be assured that those who they put in positions of trust are capable of discharging that trust with honour and in safety. Now, those two tests, the test of whether someone is proven guilty beyond reasonable doubt, and whether they are fit and proper persons to be allowed to discharge their ministry can be two different things. And you cannot produce, you could be put in a position where you have not committed a criminal offence, but you have behaved in such a way as to enable the church to question whether you should continue to discharge your priestly or other religious duties in relation to a community entrusted to your care. And they need not necessarily be the same thing.
It's a more general question. Anecdotally, when you discuss this with people in the church, they say there's no more child abuse. The priests are committing no more child abuse than any other organisation, social work, teachers, and so forth. But actually, I don't know, for the last couple of years as a journalist, I've just been getting it sort of day after day after day. Yeah. And I'm wondering, is that true, statistically?
I think if you look at the statistics, and we looked at the statistics in Rome, there doesn't appear to be a greater percentage of those in the religious life than in the general population. But you see, one of that fact in itself is still very shocking and painful for those who love the church, because many people believed in some way that if you put on the religious or priestly garb, somehow you'd be inured from the general flaws of humanity. So it's been a bit of a shock for people to realise that any proportion of the religious community could trespass in this way, because just as with a teacher or with a doctor or someone placed in a position of responsibility, when they betray the trust of the people who come to them for care and succour, it always feels worse than when somebody who does not have that responsibility does it. So I think the reason why it is probably more shocking is in people's perception, a priest, a member of the religious, someone who is committed, a member of the church, should never do this. And so I think that's part of the shock that we have to cope with, that they are, the fact that they are just human beings. I mean, shock, horror. But what we also learn from the data is something else. The John Jones research indicates that many of those who abuse in the host population and who've identified themselves as interested in young people and children have recognised that proclivity before the age of 21. And I think about 60% of them had acted on that. And therefore, we do have an opportunity for those who enter into the priesthood to prepare and scrutinise and screen them in such a way as to make it less likely that those with those particular peculiar proclivities will enter into the priesthood. So if you look at the American experience, you'll see that there's been a dramatic fall off in recent years of any form of abuse. I think, and you'd have to check the figures, there was something like 83% of the abuse had happened before the 1970s, and there was only about 8 or 9% of the abuse in America that was identified as being recent. So we know that we've made a dramatic improvement in the way to screen out. So if you look at the circular letter, what it's saying to those who train priests is we are putting specific and special responsibility on you in the process that enables people to get to the priesthood to screen these people out. So yes, it is at a level which is similar to the host population, but that is in itself shocking. And that's why the church is doing everything it can to screen people out of those who come to the religious life. And the figures look as if we're getting more and more and more successful about that. Still leaves us a problem with those who are part of the laity, those who are employed by the church, and that's still something with which we must energetically grapple. I think there's one will come to you, Sister Jane.
Maybe on that point, but what you say that there is a journey and we have a lot more work to do still, I'd like you to be as specific as possible about what is still more.
Well, I think we have done a great deal in relation to procedures. We've got to make sure the implementation of those procedures are more assured than they are now. So the auditing process that we're getting going through to enable different dioceses to be helped, to be supported, and to do as well as they'd like is very important. I particularly think we have a lot more to do in relation to understanding the victim's journey. And what we need to do to respond effectively to their identified needs. I also think there's a great deal we need to do on helping the laity to better protect them and understand what abuse looks like. And so encouraging people within the diocese to talk about these issues, to grapple them, and to give support. Now, one of the things that came out very strongly from the research is those who abuse have often seen themselves as being very lonely, isolated, and unsupported emotionally. And so for some, it's a fairly lonely existence. So acknowledging that that may be a factor, I think, means we need to look at how the diocese and the community supports their local religious community too. So it's a two-way process. So I would love to see us in the next year, I very much want to see us in the next year, concentrating on that victim experience and improving our understanding of what we can do to change and implement policies and procedures which will better address their needs. And that's not going to, and I think that's going to be easy, because they're not one, they don't come in one sort of homogenous group. There is a plethora of different needs, and I think we've really got to listen very carefully before we come to a conclusion as to how best to manage that.
That definition of lonely, isolated, and unsupported emotionally seems to apply to a lot of priests.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I mean, should the whole nature of priesthood change?
No, I think one of the things we know is that in many parishes there is a proper understanding of what the parish needs from the priest and what the priest needs from the parish. And in a parish where the priests are supported and integrated well, then there is nothing more satisfying, I think, to see. So it's not that it cannot and is not being done. I think sometimes people get very caught up in the fact we all live very busy, full lives. And I think sometimes there isn't understanding that the priests and the religious people are people too. You know, they need friendship and comfort and, you know, someone to go around and have a glass of wine with, or, you know, watch the football or whatever it is. And I think that is something that people sometimes forget, that it's a two-way process. The priest ministers to you, or the religious minister to you, but you also, as part of the laity, need to minister to them also, to enable them to be the priest and the religious they can best be. And I think sometimes there's not an appreciation, it's a two-way street.
I think it's also very much part of the formation process.
Yeah.
You know, the training and the formation of the person preparing for ministry, both in priesthood and religious life. Because the research suggests that this intimacy deficit goes back much before entering, joining. So it's a key element of the formation process, I think, which we talked about.
Yeah, and the formation process is a lot better. So the preparation for celibacy, the preparation for what entering the religious life means, has greatly improved because there's been a better consciousness that this is something that can't be left to one side, but has to be specifically looked at, prepared for, trained for, considered before someone makes the commitment to make this their long-term career for the rest of their lives. And that preparation is already appearing to bear fruit. So, for instance, if you look at the America, the fact that the celibacy has continued, but there has been a dramatic reduction in the incidence of abuse coming forward now, recent abuse, tends to mean that the preparation for those entering into the religious life in recent times must have got better. We're still, but from my point of view, we're still not where we need to be, and I have to tell you, for so long as there is one person who is abused in our country, my own feeling is that's one person too many. So our job's not done until this is eradicated, and I accept that might take a little while.
My question is just arising from what you said before about the screening. What happens if, in the course of screening, somebody is identified as either having the tendency to, or has been practicing and is escaping from? Are they coming forward now that they know that the screening is taking place, or what?
I mean, if in the course of screening for anyone in formation those issues come up, clearly they are considered not an appropriate candidate for formation, but all the support would be given in terms of ongoing therapy. And because any screening doesn't happen the day you turn up on the doorstep, you know, you've been engaged with the community or the diocese for a long time, so there would be a commitment to the support of that person in dealing with whatever they might need to deal with. Whether screening stops people coming forward, how do we know? It's a bit like the CRB checks stop people applying for jobs. And if it does, because they're a danger, that might be a good thing. But we would have no evidence of that.
Yeah. But what we do know is that the approach that's taken to identifying these issues is much better formed than it was, because people understand now what they're looking for, and there is an appreciation that this might be an issue. I don't think, frankly, in the past, people were looking for those who might abuse to come into the church. We know that abusers have quite often chosen to enter professions where they are likely to have an opportunity to be in a position of power and control. So we know that. And so we have had to come to accept that the religious life provides that opportunity for some, and we need to prevent them from entering.
But how do you identify somebody? I mean, I've seen the questionnaires, and on the on the questionnaire it said things like, "Have you ever had sex with your mother?" Or questions, really blatant questions. And of course, they're not going to say. They're not going to.
I think we need to be really clear about it. It's not a tick box issue.
But the questionnaire is.
But
that might be one part of a very thorough screening process, and you wouldn't, for most dioceses now and most religious congregations, people would be called into a 2 or 3 day complex, multifaceted screening process.
Mm.
So I don't think a questionnaire would be.
It's one small part.
It's a very, very complex and, say, very multifaceted process, which would go on and from several angles.
Yeah. And if you look at the report, one of the things we did at the conference is have some really good advice from Dr. Joe Sullivan. And one of the most challenging and painful parts of that conference was the presentation that he took people through, helping them to identify the sorts of features that you look for, also helping to identify why it is important to approach the analysis in a robust way, because you can very quickly get disclosure of things that would not otherwise be disclosed. And so we are seeking advice from people like Dr. Joe Sullivan, who is particularly skilled in dealing with sexual abuse cases and paedophiles and those who abuse young and vulnerable children. And that learning is being inculcated into the training process that's adopted to weed them out. I think we're now come to the end of our hour, so I don't know whether anyone has any burning further questions they'd like to ask before we wrap up.
I just want to ask one thing about the victims. You said you wanted to create a safe space. What does that mean practically? Is that counselling?
The safe space I was talking about was the very, very first place that people would come to.
But it's not providing counselling and that kind of thing.
And then it depends on, as we say, we've got to look at the individual needs of the individual person. And we have to find a way in the church of offering and responding to, as the Holy Father said, you know, their spiritual, their psychological and holistic needs. And we have to find, that's our challenge, to find a way through that. But the safe space I was talking about is when they first pick up the phone, they first send the email, first knock on the door. And that's vital. Because what it costs someone to do that cannot be underestimated.
And at that moment, I think what we want is for that person to get an adequate response to enable them to continue with that disclosure and feel supported in doing that.
And that might take a long time.
Yeah, it might be.
You know, they might not come back for 6 months, but the door still has to be open.
Yeah. And I think that message has to get across. And that's why I think there is so much for us to do. Because if this was a simple, straightforward, easy problem, it would have been solved a long time ago. But it isn't. It's complex. And victims come in a myriad of different forms, with a myriad of different needs, and with a myriad of different responses. So how you respond to victim A, totally appropriately, maybe totally inappropriate to respond to victim B, because it won't actually be consistent with what they need. And so you can't have a one-size-fits-all, because it usually will make it very painful for the person who has to fit within it. So we've got to have a framework, a generic approach which is capable of being sufficiently flexible to incorporate those differences. And that's why it's not easy. But we're absolutely determined to listen hard, to work even harder, to try and make sure that we can provide the help and support that will put the right guidelines in place. But it'll take a while.